I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Kimberly, host of the Start Me Up podcast. If you like your politics with some loose talk and salty language, you're going to love my show. I interview the coolest people like Mary Trump, Kathy Griffin, and DNC chair Jamie Harrison. The Start Me Up podcast has an easygoing, casual style and a strong emphasis on left-leaning politics. We also have frank discussions about sex and more than a few spirited rants. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup or wherever you get your podcasts and start listening today.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. One rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich, and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 12 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. I am one of your intrepid hosts. My name is AG, and I am joined by
Andrew Torres, and I am pleased, as always, to be here.
As am I. And we have a pretty epic episode.
Yeah, I am very, very excited. But before we begin, we'd like to thank our new patrons who went over to patreon.com/aisle45pod. Remember, guys, if you do this, you get all sorts of goodies when you sign up. You get the ability to play against us at bar trivia. That's coming up soon. Mm-hmm. So head on over. patreon.com/aisle45pod.
That's this weekend. Yeah. That's this weekend. So if you want to get in on that, you want to toss us a buck,
yeah,
you can get in on the trivia by this Saturday at noon Pacific time.
Yep. So signing up this week, and our thanks go out to Mark Voorhees, Andrew Fillmore, Mackenzie the Lion, glad that's our first Lion listener, Scott Risley, and Kimberly Richard.
Mark Voorhees is a little too close but also thanks to Marla Kirby, Nick Ward, Profile, which is pretty meta, and Will Horan.
Yeah, thank you all for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. It's what makes this possible. You get the ad-free version of the show. You get all of our goodies. You get the ability to talk to us over on the specific Patreon boards, which, you know, we respond to those messages. We respond to those comments and emails. So keep doing that. And thanks to everyone who has. Mm.
Well, first up on the cleanup docket today, Matt Gaetz, Gaetz, Pizzagate. What I don't have, there's so many names for this Gaetzgate that's happening right now. This, oddly enough, it feels like it's been going on for years, Andrew, but this started after our last episode aired last week. There, I don't think there's a lick about Matt Gaetz and his potential sex trafficking charges on the last cleanup on aisle 45.
Nope. All broke after we finished recording. So that's how new this is. So what are you hearing, EJ?
So many things. Okay. So it first started with a New York Times story that I believe broke Thursday, saying that the Department of Justice is investigating Matt Gaetz for sex trafficking of a 17-year-old a girl that he raped. Because that would be, because the age of consent is 18 in Florida.
Yep.
I'm saying raped. Now, that started the whole ball rolling. Immediately, because Matt Gaetz can't keep his mouth shut, he went on Fox News and said, I'm being blackmailed. My dad wore a wire and something. I mean, just like, what? And then he put out a series of tweets about his blackmail, basically saying, hey, I'm being extorted. Somebody named McGee, John McGee, I guess, came up to my dad, Don Gaetz, and said, hey, you gave me $25 million or I'm exposing, you know, this is, you know, this is bad. He didn't actually even give, there wasn't actually any extortion. So it's hard for me to tell the story like it was extortion because there wasn't. Then we find out McGee was like, I'm not involved in this, but McGee is a lawyer for Levinson, the Levinson family, who was an FBI agent, who, you know, the longest standing hostage we have in Iran.
Yep.
And, and then apparently some more of the news became clear where two people approached Don Gaetz and said, hey, front us $25 million. We'll try to find Levinson. We'll give y'all the credit. So that'll like help keep your son out of legal trouble. Like he'll be a hero. And then, you know, there's a reward for finding Levinson of $25 million. We'll be able to reimburse you for the money that you put forward. So it's just, and now there's orgies that are being talked about. We're being talked about Matt Gaetz showing photos of nude women on the floor of the House of Representatives where he works to other lawmakers. Dana Bash is saying she's getting texts from a bunch of people who work with Matt Gaetz that just, that she can't repeat on the air because they hate him so much. There's Ro Khanna's mixed in there. He's all just all kinds of things, but it all seems to keep boiling back down to a guy named Joel Greenberg and sex trafficking allegations.
Yeah, and the connection between Gaetz and Greenberg is undeniable. I mean, there is photographic evidence. There is, there are mountains of documents, evidence, behavior, support, right? Because Joel Greenberg was the tax county commissioner, he was a huge Matt Gaetz patron, and Matt Gaetz supported his political career. So, there is a hell of a lot of smoke surrounding this that I think, you know, from which, you know, mm-hmm. you interpret that however you interpret a lot of smoke.
Roger Stone is tied.
The right-wing freakout defense is in full blown. I mean, if you our friends over at Knowledge Fight covered the Alex Jones episode in which he had on Roger Stone to discuss the Matt Gaetz defense, and it was a 20-minute unhinged Alex Jones rant, which is to say it was Alex Jones. But talking about, like, well, and they're going after him because he's a playboy and, you know, he's been to these parties and what, like, just the kinds of things that, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you would say, Your Honor, I would like permission to put Alex Jones on thinking that he is a witness for the character of the defense.
Oh, also, and I, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but just a moments ago, there's a new breaking story. Matt Gaetz has penned his own op-ed. So going on Fox, which was a weird thing where he tried to throw Tucker Carlson under the bus by saying, you know the woman I was with, you were with me at dinner. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Went on there. Then he did the tweet thread. Then he did another tweet thread. And then he put out a video. Now he's got an op-ed.
That worked real well in Casino. But anyway, keep going.
And of course, it's in the well-regarded Washington Examiner. Thursday penned an angry op-ed insisting he would not resign. I will not resign despite of allegations of sex trafficking. Gaetz's column comes days after multiple media outlets have been talking about this whole thing. I mean, we've been going over it now for days. He offered defense of himself. He says, first, I have never, ever paid for sex. And second, I, as an adult man, have not slept with a 17-year-old, Gaetz argued.
Okay, can I jump in?
Almost.
Okay.
Predictably, he says, the anti-Trump cheerleaders such as Meghan McCain, Bill Kristol, and sadly some of my feckless colleagues in Congress are going to call for me to resign. And the reason he's doing that is because top GOP lawmakers, unnamed, but Kevin McCarthy, has said have said, if he's indicted, we're going to expel him. Republicans are going to expel him. We're going to call for him to resign first, though. We're going to call for him to resign before Democrats do. But I have a hint for these GOP lawmakers. Democrats are already calling for him to resign.
So, so act quickly. Yeah.
We don't need to wait for the indictment. But that's basically the gist of it. He did say, I'm absolutely not resigning. My lifestyle of yesteryear may be different from how I live now, but it was not and is not illegal. Consensual adult relationships are not illegal, although I'm sure some partisan crooks in Merrick Garland's Justice Department want to pervert the truth and the law to go after me. I will not be intimidated or extorted. Someone needs to explain to Matt Gaetz that this investigation was open under Bill Barr.
Yeah. So let's break down. The reason I wanted to jump in at that defense is because that is the kind of nuanced argument you would make. I'm not saying you would only make this if you were guilty of the sex trafficking statute. But I'm saying it is the kind of thing that someone guilty of the sex trafficking statute could say and technically not be lying.
Like which part?
Right? Because, so both parts, right? He said two things. He said, I have never paid for sex, and I have never had sex with someone who was underage.
Actually, he just specifically said a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Leaving open the opportunity for 16.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, put a pin in those two assertions. Let us assume, for reasons just, you know, to steal Matt Gaetz, which is a challenge, that those are true. Here is the sex trafficking statute. It is 18 U.S.C. section 1591, and it includes, I've got to read through kind of half of it because the statute includes trafficking of adults under force, fraud, and coercion, but also the trafficking of minors under the age of 18. So the offense is whoever knowingly, in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce, recruits, entices, harbors, transports, provides, obtains, advertises, maintains, patronizes, or solicits by any means a person, right? So that's A1. A2 is, or benefits financially or by receiving anything of value from participation in a venture, which is in violation of that. Knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that the person has not attained the age of 18 years and will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act, shall be punished. Okay. Now, that's a lot, but look at what those elements are.
Mm-hmm.
You have to transport a minor across state lines, recruit, entice, harbor. You have to be involved at any level.
Yeah. Harbor. Even if he did not, quote unquote, have sex with a 17-year-old, if he harbored a 17-year-old for Joel Greenberg to have sex with, for example.
If he was in any way involved with a scheme to do that, right, then he is guilty of sex trafficking.
If he helped Joel Greenberg make fake IDs for underage women for Joel Greenberg to have sex with, that is sex trafficking a minor.
If he benefited financially or by receiving anything of value for doing that, right? And it's hard to imagine he did not, when particularly as we talk about Joel Greenberg.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the connection has to be, is you have to do those two things, and the victim has to meet those two criteria. That is, under the age of 18, and will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act. A commercial sex act is defined as expansively as possible. That is, sex in exchange for anything of value. Okay. And again, I should say, like, I am deliberately reading out the adult section because I think the issues are 100% different when you're talking about, you know, potential adults involved as opposed to, you know, minors.
Now, can I ask you a hypo? Because I don't think that this is particularly the case, but I'm assuming that this may happen more often than the latter. But if you're in Florida and you're over 18, or I don't even know if you have to be over 18 to participate in child sex trafficking. Do you have to be?
No,
Yeah. So let's say you're 17 and you tell your 17, you pay your, you have your 17-year-old girlfriend cross state lines, and in exchange for sex, you put her up in a hotel. Could that be considered sex trafficking, or is that just maybe something that the feds wouldn't go after because they're both 17? And I mean, it doesn't, is it a commercial sex act?
No, it's a, I was just going to say, it to me, the difficult nexus would be whether that qualifies as a commercial sex act under the U.S. code. And let me read you the full definition.
Okay.
It's not super helpful. This is 1591 subsection E3. It says the term commercial sex act means any sex act on account of which anything of value is given to or received by any person. So when I said as expansively as possible, that's what I meant by that, right? Like I cannot envision that being written more broadly. So what I would do in that case is I would put the alleged victim on the stand and I would say, I would ask her, would you have been willing to engage in sex without crossing state lines and without having the hotel room? Was this solely, you know, for the convenience of, you know, not getting caught or whatever? And when she says yes, I would then say, so look, right, despite how broadly written it is, she was not induced to engage in sexual activity in exchange for anything, right? She was willing voluntarily to engage in sexual activity.
Got it.
So that would be the way around it in the 1717 scenario. And please don't ask me any icky questions.
Right. No.
Yeah.
No, I won't.
So thank you. I appreciate that. That's your all heart. So look, this is a right. You think of sex trafficking as a super bad offense. This is a super bad offense. OK, it breaks down. The penalties are more harsh if the victim is under the age of 14, as opposed to between 14 and 18, which is the case with the alleged victim here. Under the sentencing guidelines, the subsection B1, that is under 14, gives you a base level of 34. B2 gives you a base level of 30 and a statutory minimum of 10 years. A 30, if there are no enhancements, is 97 to 121 months, so 10 years in prison. That is the minimum if you are convicted of sex trafficking of a 17-year-old. So, yeah, these are very, very serious crimes, and we're watching it unfold.
Yeah, and tell me a little bit about sort of why Joel Greenberg sort of adds a huge commerciality to this, because what sort of things could Joel Greenberg give Matt Gaetz in return?
Campaign contributions, right? Like, look, mm-hmm. Joel Greenberg worked at the Florida Seminole County Tax Collector's Office, right? Mm-hmm. He has been a political ally and patron and booster of Matt Gaetz. And if the phrase Matt Gaetz protege doesn't make you want to turn around and start punching people, then you're not the show listeners we know and love. Greenberg was arrested in August of 2020 in the Middle District of Florida. A grand jury returned an indictment on 12 different counts. But the big one is sex trafficking statute that we just described. Mm-hmm. As you alluded to, there are these crazy allegations regarding making fake IDs, right? So that's a federal offense. You then have the unlawful means of identifying another person, identity theft in connection with the fake IDs. There's a stalking claim. It has nothing to do with the victim. It has to do with a political opponent of Greenberg's. You'll love this, where he basically got onto Facebook and Twitter, hacked the account of a school, allegedly, hacked the account of a school administrator, and then used that to try and set up his political opponent of having had sex with a minor. And the school was like, wait, none of this is real. This is all fake. But I, you know, just getting inside the head of somebody of, you know, well, I will try and paint you with what I have been credibly accused of doing.
Yeah, that seems to be sort of the MO, right? Yep. Like, say what I am guilty of, you did. And
that is the Trump playbook. So,
and there are apparently some bits of documentary evidence that of Matt Gaetz' involvement too, including Cash App payments. Apparently there's video somewhere of, I guess surveillance video, not surveillance video, but, video ring bell, the ring door. And it's something about Greenberg's office and Matt Gaetz being in there and them going through IDs together. Like there's some video out there.
That is crazy. So, late last week, the grand jury filed a third superseding indictment against Greenberg. It adds 9 counts of wire fraud. Now, remember I told you of the original 12 counts, like 11 or, wire fraud, as you know, from several years of the Mueller report, 18 USC 1343, big, hairy deal. Greenberg is now alleged, remember he's the tax collector for Seminole County, to have stolen more than $400,000 in funds so that he could buy cryptocurrency, so that he could buy Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan memorabilia, and generally write checks to himself. Why you would think that, like, that you wouldn't get caught for, like, you know, I... Did nobody else watches where the tax dollars go? It's bizarre to me. So
no, did you see that superseding indictment?
Oh yeah, I have a copy of it.
Is there anything redacted in there?
There are redacted descriptions of the offenses. So yes.
Okay, because my curiosity is now, I wonder if any of that stolen money went to somehow benefit Matt Gaetz. I mean, could he be that dumb?
Could Matt Gaetz be that dumb? I think we both know the answer to that. I will tell you this. I searched. If I thought there was anything that gave rise to anything under the redactions that would look like a Gaetz, I would have run with it and I would have told you. I can't find it. So got to stick with beans for now. But look, it's why it's significant if you can show a financial paper trail between Greenberg and Gaetz, right? Because Greenberg is just alleged to have looted nearly $500,000 in the stupidest way possible. And so if there is any financial connection between Gaetz and Greenberg, right? Like the odds, look, Greenberg took tax collector funds that belonged to the state and wrote checks to himself. So if you took any money from Greenberg, you know, how do you know that it wasn't
which money
public
it
funds?
Was.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So this looks real bad for Matt Gaetz, which, you know, makes me real happy.
Mm. Well, we will keep an eye on this because I have a feeling, I mean, this is the story that keeps on giving. It doesn't stop. Like every day there's something new. For the first couple of days, every hour we had something new come out about it. So, We'll keep on top of it for you. And if you have anything you want to add or any questions, you know, you can get a hold of us on Twitter, obviously. So do that at Aisle45Pod.
Exactly.
And we'll be right back with some more news. Stay with us. Hey, everybody, it's AG. Thanks for listening to Clean Up on Aisle 45. Today's episode is brought to you by ExpressVPN. So we all know how a VPN, or a virtual private network, allows you to create a secure connection to another network over the internet. It protects your privacy and security online, right? But I didn't know this until recently, and it's taken my TV watching game to the next level. You can use your VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Over the weekend, I used ExpressVPN to binge Star Trek Discovery on UK Netflix. It was so simple. I just fired up the ExpressVPN app, changed my location to the UK, refreshed Netflix, and that's it. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. Love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there. But the reason I use ExpressVPN is to watch shows is ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream HD no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more, so you can watch what you want on the go or on the big screen wherever you are. If you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/cleanup, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/cleanup. Everybody, welcome back. So, something that caught my attention today was Clarence Thomas's concurrence in a case called Biden v. Knight First Amendment Institute. Now, this case is kind of weird, so let me make sure I have it correct. On Monday, SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, granted certiorari in the case, immediately ruled, vacating the judgment of the Second Circuit, and then three, immediately remanded back to the Second Circuit with instructions to dismiss the case as moot?
Yep, that is exactly right. This is another one of these Trump-era cases that, you know, we would have one every 15 years until Donald Trump was in office, and now we've had six or seven of them. And it applies the Munsingware doctrine. And the reason it's doing that, right, is because Munsingware are, you know, 1930s underwear case that we've talked about on this show and elsewhere. The reason is because Munsingware is a doctrine about how the court should act when a case becomes moot because you've run out the clock. And nobody's run out the clock like Donald Trump, right? So let's set up the fact pattern. You know this. Donald Trump blocked a ton of people on Twitter. Those people were then organized by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University to file a lawsuit saying that Trump uses Twitter as a public forum. So the First Amendment applies to Trump's use of Twitter, even though it very clearly doesn't apply to ours, right? And importantly, right, for the plaintiffs here, one of the prohibitions, right, is that once a government is using a particular space as a public forum, it has to remain viewpoint neutral, right? You can't pull the same shit you do at a Trump campaign rally and just throw out people you disagree with, right? And if you don't like that, right, this is one of these things that does not require judicial intervention at all. If you don't like the rules governing a public forum, there's a super easy way around that. Don't put the stamp of the government on it, right? Donald Trump could have as many campaign rallies as he wants, but once he goes to a public forum, once he goes to a town hall, he can't just, you know, have his private security goons knock the crap out of him and throw out anybody who's a Democrat. That's why Donald Trump didn't do town halls, right?
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And if I recall correctly, the plaintiffs at both the trial court level, Trump appealed, and then that the Second Circuit Court affirmed, said, yeah, Trump uses this for official business all the time. He hires and fires people. I remember them saying, you can't block people because it's a public forum. He announces executive orders there. He conducts policy. He conducts foreign policy via Twitter. So you can't pretend like this is just my Twitter account, right?
Yep, exactly right. And the key phrase here that the Second Circuit used was interactive forum, right? So again, let's go back to the idea of a press conference or a town hall, right? Private campaign event, you're just a passive recipient. You can kick out Democrats to your heart's content. But if you're representative, oh, I don't know, let's pick out of a hat here, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and you bill an event as a town hall with your constituents so that you can charge the taxpayers for it, and if you don't think she's going to do this, you don't know Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? You can't say, oh, haha, I'm appearing here as Marjorie Taylor Greene, the private press. No, like, you are there. It's a public forum. It's interactive. The First Amendment applies. When you're interacting with your constituents, that means that it invokes the protections of the First Amendment, which include non-discrimination on the basis of viewpoints. And look, the reason that government officials get on social media platforms, right, is to interact, right? If they just wanted to make announcements, they got, you know, they got lots of ability to do that.
So is it Munsingware moot because Trump's not on Twitter anymore?
Kind of, right? Like, it is, Trump doesn't have a Twitter account. Biden doesn't conduct foreign policy this way, right? Like, it says there's no reason for us to continue to review the case. And let me tell you, I think it's moot because of that. The question about being Munsingware moot, right, says that, yeah, I love it. It says that if the rules change while you're in between, while you're in between an adverse ruling and the next court's review, the Supreme Court review, you can go back and erase the bad case law that got you there, right? The kind of like retroactive, you know, undoing the infinity gauntlet, right? Like, you can pretend like those cases never happened. And clearly, at least 5/9 of the Supreme Court views the perfectly reasonable Knight First Amendment Institute decision at the Second Circuit as bad law. So they said, Munsingware, go back, delete everything, pretend like it didn't happen. That should have been the end of it. We should have had a one-line order that said, cert granted, reversed, vacated, remanded to the Second Circuit with instructions to vacate as moot, right?
Yeah, so then, yeah, that was going to be my next question. Why did Clarence Thomas write 12 more pages? I mean, it looks like he's making two different arguments here. First, he's arguing that 1A doesn't apply to Twitter, and then he's arguing what does apply to Twitter are commercial rules about common carriers, quote unquote, common carriers, saying that Twitter is like an airline, railroad, phone company, or public shipping company.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot to unpack, so let's take a look at it. Okay, so first, on the First Amendment, I mean, there's just no other way to say it other than Thomas is just laughably, stupidly wrong, making stuff up about the First Amendment. His argument is, and I promise you, I am doing this credit. I am not oversimplifying in a negative way. His argument is, Twitter controls Twitter more than Trump controls Twitter, so you can't hold Trump responsible for anything that he does on Twitter. And if that makes no sense to you, congratulations, you're smarter than Clarence Thomas. Seriously, the response to the law about the town halls was this, and I quote directly, quote, but government officials who informally gather with constituents in a hotel bar can ask the hotel to remove a pesky patron who elbows into the gathering to loudly voice his views. The difference is that the government controls the space in the first scenario and the hotel in the latter. Now, that is a crazy person thing to say, and it is not followed or preceded by any citation to any case or law or anything, because no such case like this exists, okay? Trump did not, and the analogy is bizarre, right? Trump didn't use Twitter like he was hanging out in a hotel bar with his buddies and just happened to get bothered by a lunatic. He used it as a way to engage with lunatics, right? And the fact that Twitter had ultimate control over the account is irrelevant because Trump was the one who blocked everybody, not Twitter, right? So this is just bad, right? This is an embarrassing argument even for Clarence Thomas.
It hurts my head.
It should.
It hurts my brain. but it makes me want to hang out in a hotel bar, I've noticed.
That I am down for, yeah.
That's a feeling that I'm getting here. But what about the common carrier stuff? Isn't that a way to, just a way to read back in those restrictions?
Well, sort of. Okay, and this is where what Clarence Thomas is doing is repeating right-wing political talking points, okay? And I need to break this down a little bit because advocates of net neutrality have wanted ISPs, internet service providers, to be classified as common carriers because common carrier, like you talked about railroads, right, can't discriminate on the basis of the services that they provide, right? And so net neutrality folks have said, let's do that. Let's call Comcast a common carrier. That would prevent them from throttling the speed of their low-dollar internet customers in favor of their high-dollar ones. We broke down those arguments. It took us 2 hours on opening arguments, episode 64 to 65. Really fascinating. It's not cut and dried one way or the other. But Thomas's position is not about the internet service providers. It's about social media platforms. And this is where he's just 100% regurgitating garbage arguments from the political far right. They are hoping that they can confuse you with the similar language so that this looks like the kind of stuff that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been arguing for. And they can say, no, see, this is just, you know, common, right? This will protect you in some ways.
Mm. Yeah, so basically Thomas is arguing that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, mm-hmm. should be able to regulate all of Facebook and Twitter and impose content-based regulations on every user, but the Supreme Court can't apply a First Amendment-based restriction on the president having co-opted Twitter for his own purposes?
That is exactly right. And I wish our listeners could see your face right now. It's that's not the worst of it. The worst is footnote 5.
Footnote 5.
Just pages.
That's my new band.
Yeah, pages 11 to 12, the very end of this unhinged concurrence invokes Section 230 of the Telecommunications Decency Act of 1996.
Yeah, I knew this was the target. Yeah. This had to have been. Yeah.
And you remember this for our listeners that lack the eidetic-ness of your memory. This was a very brief Trump temper tantrum in December of 2020, in which he threatened not to sign the COVID stimulus bill unless it repealed Section 230. And look, the simplest way I can explain Section 230 is that it's what makes social media possible, right? It says Twitter is like a library and not a newspaper. And here's what I mean by that, right? Like, if I write a defamatory article about you and it gets published in a newspaper, and then you read that newspaper article in a library, you can't sue the library, but you can sue the newspaper, right? You can't sue the library. They didn't write it. I did. You can't sue the library because they didn't publish it. The newspaper did. All the library does is collects all the newspapers and says, here, read at your own risk, right?
Right. And we saw a bunch of this when, you know, I think Devin Nunes tried to sue a fake cow on Twitter, but not Twitter itself, right? But tried to move it because Twitter was based in some certain place. And lost that argument because you weren't suing Twitter.
That is right. And that is exactly right. The reason he didn't even try to sue Twitter is because Twitter could have moved to dismiss Section 230, statutory immunity, go the hell away. And even somebody as stupid as Devin Nunes knew not to sue all of Twitter. If Section 230 were to be repealed, Devin Nunes could sue all of Twitter for what at Devin Nunes's mom says on Twitter. Now, look, there may be good reason. Like, I do not want us to be taking the position that Section 230 is a panacea, that there aren't problems with it. Look, like, it was written in 1996. It uses words that make no sense, right? It uses interactive computer service because they're thinking of AOL with the little CD that you plug in, right? Like, so that there, I don't mean to say that Section 230 is perfect or what, but I do mean to say that what we see here is the right-wing activist Supreme Court saying, oh, Trump couldn't get 230 repealed through Congress, even though he was the president and controlled the Senate, so let's have the Supreme Court do this for him. And it's just, it's disgusting. It is exhibit number 8 billion in our activist Supreme Court.
Well, and to me, that just seems like that's what he's doing, right? Paving the way.
Look, once an argument is listed in a concurrence or in a separate dissent, right, you can now cite back to that in later opinions, right? You can force the court to talk about this as if you're doing something other than citing yourself. And this is how crazy pants ideas get promulgated in, and again, it's not just the right wing that does this, but it is the right wing that has done this to marvelous efficiency over the past 30 years. The most obvious example being inventing out of whole cloth a brand new jurisprudence around the Second Amendment that enabled the court to hide behind a veneer of, no, look, like, see, we have real citations in this, but all of their citations were to law review articles citing to Scalia dissents, which then Scalia cited to those law review articles back in. This is what they're trying to do. It doesn't always work, but this is the first step for it working.
Gross.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. And if there were ever a lawyer that might be interested in taking a case like that to court, it could be the subject of our interview with Adam Klasfeld. You don't want to miss it.
Oh, man. This is great. Please do stick around. This is a fantastic interview with a lot of behind-the-scenes knowledge.
Yep. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's AG, and this portion of the pod is brought to you by Policy Genius. This time of year, I always do my spring cleaning and get my house in order, but you can get your financial house in order, too, and get a head start by revisiting your home and auto insurance with Policy Genius. Policy Genius can help you kill two birds with one stone. You can compare home and auto insurance rates, and you can save up to $1,055 per year by reshopping. That's money you can put towards things that you really care about. So first, here's what you do. You head to PolicyGenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius will take it from there. They compare rates to over 30 top insurers from Progressive Progressive to Nationwide and find your lowest rates. The Policy Genius team will look at all the ways to maximize your savings too, including bundling your home and auto policy. And if Policy Genius finds a better rate than what you're paying now, they'll switch you over for free. They do all the heavy lifting. It's no wonder that with that level of service, Policy Genius has earned a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. If you're worried that this year is flying by and you've barely gotten anything done, take a deep breath. Policy Genius has it all figured out. They will help you make the most of this month in minutes. Just reshop your home and auto insurance and you could save up to $1,055. So head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. Everybody, welcome back to Clean Up on Aisle 45. Andrew Torres and I today are joined by the host of the Objections podcast. He's also at Law and Crime. Please welcome Adam Klasfeld. Adam, it's nice to speak to you.
Nice to speak to you again, too.
So, this latest episode of Objections, some of the within the first 15 minutes, it's already like I have a murder board with yarn and photos and everything trying to connect all these dots. But this is about Lynn Wood. And I know Andrew Torres and I have spoken probably excessively about Lynn Wood in the past. But this story is new. You have the exclusive and the scoop. And I was wondering if you could tell me some of the top line points of what you found out through this process of investigative reporting.
So my first episode of the podcast, Objections, went into a litigation between Wood and his former law partners that started with exclusive tapes. Now, this latest episode is an outgrowth of that because that lawsuit with his former partners talks about this, what the partners describe as an unraveling that happened in the late 2019, early 2020 timeframe, where they claim that he described himself as the second, possibly the second coming of Christ. They claim two of the former partners accused him of assault. And someone, a source, reached out to me over the making of this podcast and said, came to me with a very similar story. He said that Lynn Wood assaulted him, that this attack happened shortly before the 2020 election, and that he had tapes that showed him, we found out as I started listening to these tapes, they started having a lot of the same themes that I had come to become familiar with the other litigation with the former law partners. So we were exploring this period in Lynn Wood's career. Now, to take a little step back here, Lynn Wood was a prominent defamation lawyer. He represented JonBenet Ramsey. He used to have a very different name before the 2020 election when he became associated with this Kraken litigation to overturn the election. A person who served as executive director of his Fight Back Foundation, David Hancock, had also run security at his house, known as a Tamatli plantation, a former plantation, and just gave insights into what was going on in his life as this Lynn Wood of that kind of reputation of the prominent defamation attorney was starting to become known as the other Lynn Wood, a kind of rising star of the political right. He became known for other clients, one of the most prominent of whom was Kyle Rittenhouse, the accused Kenosha shooter. And so part of what this person who was the executive director of his Fight Back Foundation had become a part of that Fight Back Foundation, that used to be associated with Kyle Rittenhouse. And so that's one of the top line points of the episode, is the transformation of Lynn Wood. The second top line point of the episode is what happened in Wood's former association with the Kyle Rittenhouse case. Now, Dave Hancock, the former executive director, former Navy SEAL, was a supporter of Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah, I thought the interview with Hancock was really persuasive to me, right? Like, you know, as a lawyer, my job is to evaluate the credibility of witnesses. And Hancock says things that those of us, you know, sort of proudly on the left who have been touting Linwood as crazy person would never say, right? Like he describes, you know, the genius of Linwood and talking to him about, you know, various Supreme Court opinions. He describes also you hear Hancock, you know, as an aside, right, say like, well, you know, and obviously, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse acted in self-defense, which that's not obvious to at least 2/3 of the panel here. I don't want to speak for you, Adam.
So, you know, in approaching this episode, I'm approaching everything from the point of view of a journalist. Like I'm not taking, someone tells me that they support Kyle Rittenhouse, I'm reporting their story, and I will be reporting the prosecutor's side of the story. So, you know, so far as that goes.
And was it Hancock who said he was starstruck when he first met?
Absolutely.
Linwood? Yeah. So it's a very different sort of perspective, right, that we're used to sort of dealing with on either this show or the Daily Means or opening arguments. You know, it's just a kind of a different perspective. But I think, Andrew, what you were getting at was that it makes his story very credible, right? Like he really, really respects this guy and has so many great things to say about him in the lead up that it kind of gives more punch to what he's ultimately gets at, which is that transformation you were talking about, right, Adam?
Right. So in terms of how lawyers and journalists gauge credibility, you look at things like, is it just a series of insults? Does the guy appear to have an axe to grind? And I think that's one of the things you're getting at, Andrew. And another thing is, you know, so far in many ways, they shared political ends. Dave Hancock and Lynn Wood both believed that Kyle Rittenhouse acted in self-defense. So that's the kind of perspective that he was coming from. The other way that you gauge credibility is, how does it match up with other evidence that they have? And the remarkable part of this story is that Dave Hancock produced tapes that he took of him and Lynn Wood. And a lot of those tapes really do appear to corroborate some of the things that he was saying, which is why we ran them.
Well, and let's add your part in this, which is you sent Lynn Wood questions to which he provided recorded answers that you played back during the podcast. And again, for somebody who thought he was going on to the Supreme Court, want to ask you about that. These are not answers that a lawyer would ever counsel, you know, somebody to give in public, let alone, you know, give on your own behalf. I don't want to spoil too much of the podcast. It's a fascinating and fabulous, episode. But it also buttressing, right? Like kind of the third leg buttressing that story are Lynn Wood's own words.
Right. And that's how I would approach any story.
Yeah.
That, you know, if I have, and Lynn Wood has apparently responded to this episode on Telegram to his 800,000 followers. And part of it has involved sharing a portion, not the whole thing, but a portion of our email exchange. And it shows that I quite extensively told him what's on the tapes and sought his comment. And in approaching any story, what are his own words? In many instances, he doesn't dispute the substance of the conversation. Yeah. Sometimes he confirms it. Sometimes he does make a dispute with varying degrees of specificity, but we include his response.
Yeah.
He left a voicemail to me, and that voicemail is part of the show.
An unhinged voicemail, yeah. I would say.
And I have to say, I have to congratulate you on your approach to this, your journalistic approach and your integrity on this, because I go by very different standards. My standards are, do they have a punchable face? Are they a Republican? And do they agree with me? Because those are the three most important things to me, and whether or not I make speculation. So I do appreciate your approach. approach on this, because like Andrew was saying, the amount of stuff corroborating this guy's story, the former Navy SEAL, and along with, you also spoke to, I believe you spoke to Kyle Rittenhouse's mom.
That's correct. So how that came about, one of the allegations here, now I mentioned a little bit earlier that Dave Hancock, the former Navy SEAL, was the executive director of Linwood's Fight Back Foundation. And Linwood even tweeted about him, you know, identifying him as such. And they had a falling out, and that falling out I'll had say. To do with an previously unreported gun incident that we'll talk about a little bit later. But part of that incident had to do with the direction of this Fight Back Foundation. And during an interview with me, David Hancock claimed that Wendy Rittenhouse asked Linwood for an accounting, and that he effectively blew her off. He wouldn't provide it. And I asked Linwood about that. He denied it. And so we had a he said story at one point, Dave Hancock versus Linwood, about what she said, Wendy Rittenhouse. So eventually I just had to get Wendy Rittenhouse's side of the story. And that turned into a top line revelation of this story, which is that Wendy Rittenhouse demanded an accounting. Wendy Rittenhouse claims that Linwood wanted Kyle Rittenhouse to remain in jail even after they had raised the bail money that would have allowed him to get out. In her words, that she claims that Linwood believed that there would be a post-election Armageddon. That was the word she used, an Armageddon, and that he would be safe in jail because society was falling apart. And that was a pretty explosive revelation. I asked Linwood about it. He supplied his response, which is in the episode. But that's how that came about. We had a an accusation coming from Dave Hancock. Linwood answered it with a denial, and Wendy Rittenhouse backed up Dave Hancock's side of the story.
Yeah, I also think you may be contacted by the firm that represents Linwood's former law partners, because as you mentioned at the top of the episode, they have filed a lawsuit against Linwood. And essentially the argument goes something like this. It says Linwood's behavior has become so erratic and crazy that it's compromised the business of the firm, right? And so in particular, when I first covered this lawsuit on Opening Arguments, I was drawn to paragraph 164. It's on page 52, and it says, right, and basically it says that Linwood settled a case prematurely because he thought, this is the allegation, that they would reveal embarrassing information about him, Linwood, right? And that's a real problem if you are a law firm, right? And you have partners who are, you know, dedicated to number one, serving your client, and number two, enriching the firm, and number three, like, you know, protecting Linwood from accusations of being a crazy person are in that particular order. And here's the allegation in the paragraph. It says, defendant Wood had repeatedly voiced his concerns about his misconduct being disclosed, as he feared it would interfere with his imminent receipt of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and appointment as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The latter belief was based on two things. Number one, a decades-plus-old prophecy that defendant Wood heard in a YouTube video. And number two, something he's since publicly tweeted about, a conspiracy theory that Chief Justice John Roberts would be revealed to be a part of Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring. I want to talk about that second part, but the first part just seems bonkers, right?
So Miss Cleo told him.
Yeah, he watched a YouTube video with a prophecy. You asked him about that, and why don't I just set that up as the question for you?
Right. I did ask Dave Hancock about that prophecy, and he replied with very specific answer. He said that he had heard Linwood talk about it, that the prophecy was about from a self-proclaimed prophet named Kim Clement, who has a YouTube video that you know, my research found had, you know, as of the time that we're talking, has been viewed millions of times. I forget the exact number. And
980,000 by Lynn Wood.
And it's, and in the prophecy, you know, described by Clement and his acolytes, Clement said that two would resign in disgrace from the highest court in the land. His believers believe that Mr. Clement predicted the Trump presidency. And so that's a story that Hancock said that he heard from Lynn Wood. And that's something that tracks the allegations of the lawsuit that you mentioned. It's right there and has, you know, been out there for a very long time. And that goes to another point, because right now, Lynn Wood is still presenting his conspiracy theory that Chief Justice Roberts is part of Jeffrey Epstein's pedophile ring, based on this whole idea that there was a John Roberts in Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, he was in Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs on the same day that Chief John Roberts of the Supreme Court was presiding at the Supreme Court. So it doesn't really wash. I mean, it's a conspiracy theory.
Well, I almost believed it up until that alibi came out.
Yeah. Right, right. I mean, one of the people who actually pointed that out was Lynn Wood's former client, Nick Sandman, the Covington Catholic student, you know, debunking Lynn Wood, his former lawyer's conspiracy theory. But essentially, in terms of that conspiracy theory, he's still pushing it. And the lawsuit and the allegations that are reported on this episode show that he has held that for a long time, predating the 2020 elections.
I have a legal question for Andrew before we get out of here, kind of based on all this, because as I was listening to this episode, thinking about what it takes to get disbarred as an attorney, and it always has to do with mismanagement or stealing clients' funds, right? It's got to be pretty up there. Otherwise, it's sanctions, which we've seen him kind of go through a little bit in Wisconsin, I believe. But I was just had all these memories of Avenatti coming back into my head, and so I think that the question that I have here is for disbarment, do you have to prove intent? Because I mean, if he technically thinks that there was a prophecy and doesn't, you know, wasn't actually trying to bilk the Rittenhouses or anything like that, I was wondering kind of, I guess, what the standard of proof is for a disbarment.
Yeah, you do not have to prove intent. Lawyers are kind of drilled from sort of day one that you're admitted to the bar, that, you know, malpractice, you know, misconduct will get you sanctions, but mishandling client funds will get you disbarred. And all of those, by and large, are strict liability offenses, right? Like, you commingle funds, it may be an interesting part of the story as to why you commingled the funds, but it's the commingling of the funds that serves as the disbarrable offense. I will say that the Lynn Wood case, I kind of have this theory that maybe those rules are about to change now that we have misconduct of a sort that I think lawyers couldn't have envisioned 10 years ago, right? Seditious conspiracy to bring down the United States and flood the court with patently frivolous allegations, you know, backed up by secret experts named Spider, right? Like, and so when Lynn Wood tweeted out the John Roberts, Jeffrey Epstein sex stuff, He represents Carter Page in Delaware, right? And the judge in Delaware, sua sponte, issued a show cause order that said, I've admitted Lynn Wood here pro hoc vice, and I realized, like, this is just a, you know, a court in Delaware, like, this is just my domain, but, like, I have an obligation to make sure it's not populated by idiots and frauds. Defend yourself. And Lynn Wood did, and the judge was like, yeah, no, get out of here, and revoked his pro hoc vice motion.
And the co-counsel on that case was John Pierce,
yep,
who was the co-founder of the Fight Back Foundation.
There it is, yeah.
So it's a he is another figure. Around the time that of Fight Back's formation, there were lots of lawsuits alleging massive debts. What this episode raises further questions about, we have Wendy Rittenhouse and Dave Hancock demanding an audit. His response to that audit is that audit request is, we will comply with any audit demanded by law. If the law demands it, he'll comply with it. That was Linwood's response. But it will shine a light on this demand. Why is another former client saying that this 501c4, you know, what do the books say? What have they been doing with the money now that you have two of the former people tied to that organization demanding that audit?
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating story. There are so many pieces to it and so many parts to it. We didn't have time to get to the gun incident, but you can hear a tape of it if you listen to the latest episode of Objections with Adam Klasfeld. You really need to hear this episode. I wish we had an hour to talk, but that's sort of what your episode is for. So I encourage everybody to go listen to it. And I appreciate you taking the time to answer our questions today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Everybody, Adam Klasfeld, check it out. It's called Objections, and you can also find him at Law and Crime. I appreciate your time, and we'll be right back, everybody, with comings and goings. Stick around. Hey, everybody, it's AG, and this segment of the podcast is brought to you by the best thing ever in the universe. It's called Magic Spoon Cereal. It's incredibly delicious, a super healthy cereal that brings joy to your mornings or afternoons or evenings or nighttime. My favorite food growing up was always cereal. I remember watching cartoons, munching on a big bowl of cereal. Usually you would eat like a whole box and then drink the delicious milk afterwards, watching Saturday morning cartoons. But as an adult trying to eat healthier, I've had to give up cereal because it's usually full of sugar, chemicals, and other junk. But I recently tried Magic Spoon, and it tastes exactly like regular cereal from your childhood, but it is super nutritious. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. And only it's 140 calories. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. And exciting news, Magic Spoon is releasing 2 amazing new flavors for a limited time only. We're talking about cookies and cream and maple waffle. And if that isn't the most comforting, indulgent combination, I do not know what is. This is the ultimate treat-yourself combo, so make sure you get some while you can for a limited time, or build your own box. Available flavors to build your very own custom bundle are cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, and cinnamon. I love the great new flavors. Combining them is amazing too. Cocoa and peanut butter is delicious, for example. So go to magicspoon.com/cleanup, grab the new limited edition cookies and cream, maple waffle, or custom bundle, and try it today. And be sure to use promo code cleanup at checkout to save $5 off your order. The offer is now good anywhere in the US or Canada, but only when you use our code at checkout. And Magic Spoon is so confident, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. So no risk. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/cleanup and use code cleanup to save $5 off. Everybody, welcome back. What an incredible interview. I love talking to Adam Klasfeld, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
Just such a great reporter. So much more integrity than my punch people in the face way.
This is punch people in the face episode, right? I mean, when you lead up, when the A block is about Matt Gaetz, I mean, that is... Future encyclopedia will converge on Matt Gaetz for the
his
photo
punchable
of punchable face. Yeah. Anyway.
Him and Skrillex. I'm with you. Okay. Anyway, remember last week when we talked about Biden tasking the EPA to go through all the former guy's policies and shit can the ones not authored by the agency or that weren't based on favors or that actually were based on favors instead of science? You know, like, we didn't author any of these things. And there was upwards of 90 things. Uh-huh. That fell into the shit can category. Well, this week, according to the Washington Post, the Environmental Protection Agency administrator, that's Michael Reagan, we talked about him last week, will purge more than 40 outside experts appointed under Trump from 2 key advisory panels, a move he says will help restore the role of science at the agency and reduce the heavy influence of industry over environmental regulations. Gosh, I can't imagine industry like the fossil fuel industry would want some sort of power over the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, it's an unusual decision. It was announced Wednesday, and it's going to sweep away outside researchers picked under the previous administration whose expert advice helped the agency craft regulations and policy related to air pollution, the oil and gas extraction method known as fracking, and other issues like that.
Yeah, so goodbye to you. critics have noted, including us, have noted that under the former guy, membership on these two panels. So that is, the first was the EPA's Science Advisory Board. That sounds nice, right? And the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, that they were biased in favor of regulated industries, and that their positions were frequently outside the scientific mainstream. And look, this is, as we talked about last week, one of just several moves designed to try and reestablish some kind of scientific integrity across the federal government after what officials have characterized as a, quote, concerted effort under the previous president to sideline or interfere with research on climate change, COVID, all the issues that you can think about. And look, this is really, really important for the way in which the Administrative Procedure Act works, right? Because to change the rules, when you engage in new rulemaking, you have to say that you have conducted fact-finding. You have to have done the research. And that's why they went through the rigmarole under the other guy of putting these folks in here who would say, oh, yes, we absolutely did do the research.
Yeah. Well, the interesting part is Republicans are now responding to this move.
Okay. Oh, what are they saying, AG? Tell us.
Well, oddly, it's the same shit they said about the initial review last week, that Biden is undermining confidence in the agency by kicking out those with contrary views. Think about that for a second. You're degrading the EPA by firing people with contrary views to science.
Yeah, it's the teach the controversy at writ large at the government. Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. Now, both Reagan, who and we here at Cleanup on Aisle 45 concede that it's not always clear how science should inform policy. However, I think we're all pretty satisfied with the clarity of the underlying science. Yeah. And that was the same thing last week, too. They're like, you're kicking out people with all opposing viewpoints. Opposing viewpoints on science is different than an opposing viewpoint on how to turn it into policy.
Yeah, and look, this is a thing that the law is well prepared to address, right? Courts every day have to determine whether to admit expert testimony, right? And one of the criteria for expert testimony is, does this expert's testimony reflect the mainstream views of science? Does it use methodology that is testable, that is repeatable? All those sorts of criteria, right? That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about, like, you know, kicking out everybody with one position on one view. We're talking about kicking out folks who are masquerading as cargo cult science. I can't emphasize how important that is.
Yeah, alternative science. Yeah, right? Yeah. So speaking of how, now, you know, we talked a lot about the science of it and why these folks are leaving, but talking about how science becomes policy. These advisory panels played a role in that, right? Converting the actual science into policy.
Yeah. And again, this was set up before everything was broken, right? So Congress creates the advisory boards because, remember, every executive agency is acting under the powers delegated to it by Congress, right? They don't inherently have authority. They have delegated authority from Congress to act within the confines of their instructions. And the advisory panels are designed to then provide executive branch officials, the policymakers, with the best advice from experts from a range of backgrounds. So, again, whenever you see that these members on these boards served 3-year terms, right? And whenever you see an odd number, right, that is some legislator going, well, let's do my best to make this nonpartisan, right? Because 3 years is, you know, 50% longer than a congressional term. It means, you know, they're likely to come up in between elections, that sort of thing. So the members of the advisory boards, their recommendations are not binding, right? But they do carry weight when you're developing the policy, again, because of the Administrative Procedures Act, right? Because you can now cite, you know, we agreed to, you know, expand the level of friable asbestos that we permit to be imported into the United States because, you know, we found the following 4 things. And then you can drop a footnote and you can say, you know, so-and-so on the science advisory board said, well, actually, like, I put asbestos on my cornflakes every morning and I'm fine, right? Yeah. So that's what's important. But look, this move is not just about kicking out, like, the science deniers, right? I mean, like, can we talk about, like, other ways in which the other guy's administration undermined those advisory panels' integrity?
Yeah, there's more than one way, because, as a matter of fact, remaking the composition of the panels is necessary after the former guy's administration illegally barred academics who received EPA grants from serving on the advisory panels. Now, I know it gets better. The administration had argued that scientists who received research funding would not be impartial in their advice. But, you know, Rex Tillerson's son would be great. I'm not saying he was on the panel, just giving an example. But environmental and public health advocates, along with some former career officials within the agency, said the policy effectively elevated experts from industry while muzzling independent scientists. And I'm pretty sure that doesn't just sound idiotic, because the courts agreed, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Look, the Trump administration ended up rescinding that restriction on grant recipients after being ordered to do so last year by a federal court, right? But, of course, that didn't change any of the appointments to the board, and it didn't change any of the substantive rulemaking that was enacted during that interregnum. So EPA is now calling for new applications for the two panels, right? Here's the hilarious part. Nick Conger, an EPA spokesman, said that advisors fired from the committees are, quote, eligible and encouraged to reapply if they so choose. Okay. So normally, like, the agency would have asked for, you know, new applications for the handful of positions later this year. What do you think we might see on some of these resumes for the examples of their good work under the former administration?
Well, here's, yeah, if any of these folks reapply, they can say, hey, I was on the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, and I advised the EPA to keep the standards for ozone at the current level, even as public health experts outside the agency and pretty much everyone else in the frickin' world argued that they should be tightened to help protect poor and minority communities. That's one example. The agency followed the committee's advice and declined to issue stricter standards for the smog-forming pollutant, which has been linked to asthma and lung disease. Another guy, the guy Trump picked to lead the Clean Air Advisory Committee, named Louis Anthony Tony Cox, I have to say it in that voice.
Fat Tony, sure, love that guy.
Is a consultant who has worked for several government agencies, but also for the oil, coal, pork, and chemical industries. It's a weird combination.
I think it's because of the giant shit lagoons at commercial pig farms. Anyway,
so keep going. Cox dismissed the EPA's methods for tabulating the public health benefits of smog regulations. He said they were unreliable, logically unsound, and inappropriate. That position distressed many air pollution scientists, as you might imagine. Two, in fact, published a paper in the journal Science that warned that Cox wanted to fundamentally change the EPA's process for scientific assessment. So those are just two examples of some of these 40 now fired people who are encouraged to reapply for these positions, which I think is a nice way of just sort of saying, fuck you forever.
Yeah, bye-bye. Man, I'm glad we ended on that one, because it really does underscore the fact that the last administration was not just trying to change the outcome, they were trying to change the rules, right? And they're still doing that, right? And, mm-hmm. and like, process arguments are harder to explain and win and feel passionate about. So the takeaway here is, right, keep looking at not only, you know, what is the substantive outcome, but also how do we get there?
Yeah. Yep, and there's going to be a lot more of these, I have a feeling. But, you know, like you said, Andrew, normally next year sometime, they might say, oh, we got five new people we need to put on the advisory board. 40 people from two advisory boards, yep. And in the first 70 days. So that's how urgent it is and how much they were denying it.
That's another great point. Again, like, this is so far an administration that is doing the hard work behind the scenes that only, like, you and me and our listeners, you know, care about or even know about. You know, this is not going to feature in any 2022 campaign ads. But they're devoting real resources and time to it, because we have to, because because everything is at stake if we don't, you know, root this kind of institutional roadblocks out, you know, root and branch. So good job. Mm-hmm.
It is all part of cleanup on aisle 45.
Oh, that's why you're the best.
There's going to be so much more to talk about, and we will cover it all. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our patrons. We will see you this Saturday at noon, patrons, for our trivia challenge, our pub trivia challenge. Pub meaning, you know, it's virtual, but we, I guess, have a beer if you're into it. And it's going to be absolutely wonderful. It's just me and Andrew on one team. You can have up to 5 people on your team. It's just me and Andrew. And there will be an 80s pop culture category. So I'm very excited.
That's where we're going to catch up. If at any point we fall behind, I feel real good about our chances in that category.
Yeah, either that or god awful movies would be good at. All right, everybody, until next week. Thank you again for listening to episode 12 of Cleanup on Aisle 45. We'll see you next time.
Bye bye.
Cleanup on Aisle 45 is written and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres and is engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Fact-checking and research by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres with quality assurance and media by Muller She Wrote LLC. Branding, design, and logo by Starburns Audio and Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our copy is written by Jesse Egan. Our music is written and recorded by Adam Orr and Christopher Hoffey, and our opening sequence was designed by Allison Gill and mixed by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Follow us on Twitter at Aisle45Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Don't miss our Cleanup on Aisle 45 after party over on the Stereo app. We'll be going live every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 Eastern, and we want to hear from you. Our first stereo show went a little bit like this.
These big corporations are donating money to politicians that are trying to suppress the vote. And that public pressure got them to come out and go, we oppose this, right? So your voice does matter. People just like you have made a difference. And I love, you're going to hear this on tomorrow's cleanup, but Allison has a spectacular analogy that I'm not going to spoil on tonight's Q&A, involving the fact that these Republican efforts target Republicans as well, right? And so it's so good, and I don't want to spoil it, but their thought process is, yeah, we don't care if we wind up suppressing some Republican votes because we're suppressing more Democratic votes, and that gives you an opportunity to build coalitions with people who care about having their voices. Can you build a coalition with Uncle Frank? No, you can't. But there are a lot of working class pro-Trump people who are like, yeah, you know what? I'd kind of like to be able to vote on the weekend because, you know, I work second shift. And otherwise, like, voting in person on a Tuesday sucks, right?
Yeah.
Lots of opportunities like that. So I hear you. Don't put aside the despair and focus on the positive, and hopefully we've given you some concrete options there.
Stereo app is live social conversations, and they're awesome, and we want to talk directly with you, our listeners. So you can join our show, ask questions about news, politics, or anything, and you can share your experiences and opinions. We want to hear it all. So download now and join us live this week. Link to our show in the description, and join us over on the Stereo app.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.